above you'll see navigation buttons. The protocol that we use here is that the speaker will announce the slide number that they are moving to, and you can click the single arrow to the right to follow along with him. He does not control the slides. You'll also notice that there is a question button above the slide. You may use that at any point during the session to interject a question. They will be captured on another screen and interjected when we come to the Q&A sessions. If you're joining us via simulcast and run into any kinds of technical problems, we ask that you use that question button, let us know what kind of problem you're having, and give us a phone number where we can behind the scenes call you and help troubleshoot that problem. So again, I'd like to get started. Again, today's session is on jump-starting ecological restoration. Those phone participants, please help us out. Put your phones on mute, *6 right now, or put it on mute, and we can get on with the session. Again, my name is Jeff Heimerman. Today, our speaker is Dr. Stephen Handel from Rutgers University. He's been working with EPA on a lot of different remedial projects and training courses regarding ecological restoration. He studies the potential to restore native communities to many habitats and works with both biologists, landscape designers to trying to improve our understanding of protocols on how to actually accomplish this. So he's got a lot of practical knowledge to impart. We're glad to have him here with us. As I did mention, this is Stephen has helped us out training a lot of our site managers and response personnel over the years, and the topic that we have today is actually a subsection of a 3-day course that we have on revitalization and ecological restoration that we post periodically during the year. So we're going to try and pull pieces of that course out over the next year and offer it on this kind of a platform. And with that, I think I better shut up and turn it over to Dr. Stephen Handel. And Stephen, would you please take it away?
Thanks a lot, Jeff. Hi, folks. This is Stephen Handel. I'm sitting in New Jersey at my university office. I'm a plant ecologist, and I've gotten very interested in what we could do to improve the American landscape. You know, conservation means we save the little bits of pieces we have of habitats. Restoration means adding back pieces. And a lot of degraded and disturbed sites are parcels that could be made into functioning habitats. And my job today is to tell you folks about some case studies and examples we've done in the East Coast of the United States to show what could be done to bring back healthy, beautiful, and useful habitats to sites that have been damaged or degraded in some ways. What I'm going to do is go through first what we do in site preparation, and then talk a bit about how we add back vegetation, and then finally give you a few case studies that I've worked on that I think are of wide interest. I'm going to stop a few times during my talk to pause and ask for some relevant questions. So first about soil, and then about plants, and then more generally. So why don't we just start going through the slides? If you could all go to slide number 2. This is a snapshot of a landfill in the city of New York that I've done a lot of work on. It's called Fresh Kills. And it shows a site which is a great engineering success. This is a household garbage which has been covered by a cap and then a overburden of soil and then hydroseeded with grass seed. This is an engineering success in the sense that the garbage is covered, precipitation can't get into the garbage, and the site is static. It'll stay this way for many, many years, and the City of New York Sanitation Department spends a lot of time keeping it look just like this. That pipe in the foreground is, of course, for venting methane. When I first went to this site, I said, you know, in terms of civil engineering, this is fine, but in terms of ecology and service to the citizens of New York, this is a disaster. Is there some way we can add back ecological services, ecological structure to this, and also complement the engineering needs? And that's what got me started on this discipline of restoration ecology. Go to slide 3. This snapshot shows a healthy habitat not far from New York, And I like it because it shows what a normal, healthy habitat could look like in a very, very small grade. From the top of this hill to the toe of slope, there must be 400 to 500 species of plants, all living there with no management, no maintenance, and giving great value to society. In the back is a woodland, nothing rare or endangered, but maybe a dozen trees, 20 shrubs, and 50 kinds of wildflowers. The middle ground is a pasture with a completely different plant community maintained that way by livestock. And in the foreground, where the soil is wetter, we have a wetland of rushes and sedges, very different from the rest of the picture. These kinds of complex habitats add so much to the quality of life of our citizens, and I ask the question, can we in fact bring back this kind of habitat along a slope instead of what you saw in the previous slide, just a monoculture, a biodiversity of one species, along a slope? I'm interested in these kinds of natural habitats not just because they're pretty and they harbor dicky birds, but they really can help our citizens and our economy. Please go to slide 4. In my field, we tend to talk now about ecosystem services or ecological services. What we get as citizens and as land managers out of natural systems that we don't have to pay for after installation. And I'm sure a lot of you folks are aware of these things. Natural habitats help clean and cool the air, maintain proper groundwater. By controlling groundwater, they mitigate against floods and droughts, certainly something in the news these days. They help soils from washing away, maintaining healthy soils down through the decades. They control nutrients so our waters don't get eutrophied with too many nitrates and other sorts of nutrients, which, when we have too many in our waters, ruin the water quality. And, of course, they help stabilize climate by cooling local airs. We're all aware of the heat island effect in cities, how cities heat up the atmosphere so much, making it so expensive to cool our homes and factories. If we're surrounded by healthy habitats, the air is cooler, and we save literally a fortune in energy costs. We can do these things with native plants. And a lot of folks ask me, why just natives? Can't we just buy anything from Joe and Josie's nursery down the block? But I think there's some great value of using natives. Please go to slide 5. Native plants are better for this kind of work for a lot of reasons. They certainly fulfill those ecological values we just listed. But native plants have lived here on our continent for millennia, and they are best adapted for our local conditions, and they often have natural resistance to pests and pesticides. So the maintenance and management of native plants should be much cheaper and much easier for long-term sustainability. Many of our native plants have secondary values. We get medicines and herbals from them. Sometimes you can get food, and they certainly supply habitat, both food and resting habitat, for our wildlife as they sweep through the continent. We want our habitats, after we restore them, to be there for a long time, with very little concern for management or public budgets to maintain them. Native plants offer us the best possibility for that to happen. And in all of our work, we always use natives. We don't use routine landscape plants. They certainly are beautiful, but they're plants which are used that require high maintenance and often spraying to keep pests off and so on. Often, of course, when you get plants that are grown at commercial nurseries, they don't have the diverse genotypes you need for long-term sustainability. Please go to the next slide. The federal government has been aware of this, and there's now an executive order out of the White House saying that native species are to be used in all federal projects where possible. And also, there's an executive order to control invasive species, aliens from Asia or Europe, which are sweeping through almost all of our habitats in North America and cause an enormous problem for public amenities. And I'll chat a little bit more about that later. Thinking more broadly, a restoration can play a role as a partner for the conservation by adding back clusters or populations of plants which are locally uncommon. here in the New York, New Jersey area, there are hundreds of species which are now rare because of land use change and construction. By adding back little clusters of them now, I can help these species stay in our ecosystem and even spread as birds and other things carry seeds about. So there's a lot of reasons to use natives, and they all come down to use and function and even saving budget. My interest in restoration is not just on landfills and in urban lots and on roadsides in metropolitan areas, but I think this is of use for other kinds of habitats that land managers and engineers and ecologists deal with. If you go to the next slide, number 7, this is a picture of a strip mine, coal strip mine in West Virginia, that I worked on for a few years with EPA Region 3. This is a landscape where the mountaintop was blown off and the sandstone removed. The coal seam was then removed, and then the coal company put back some coarse sandstone, fertilized it, and added grass seed. Again, this is now a landscape which is green, but it's trivial biodiversity, very little ecological services, and very poor habitat. Through time, this landscape really won't get better. What once was there was one of the richest forests in North America, and that's seen at the back of this slide. Restoration ecology could play a role here in trying to get this old mining landscape back into something which is more useful, sustainable, and down the line could have great economic advantage. The forestry industry was enormous in West Virginia. If we could get a forest back here, the folks who live there would have another source of income now that the coal seam is gone. Please go to the next slide, number 8. This is another area where we can do restoration. This is a city park where the engineering outfit had to put in a new sanitary waste main, and that's that pipe in the ground. We were asked after the installation of the new pipeline to try to restore wetland plants, since this was going to be a very wet soil. So here, as a partner to engineering, after the pipe is buried, we can put something back on top that could help restore the American landscape, instead of leaving it a blank, flat, hydroseeded area. These are the things I want to do as a restoration ecologist. I don't want to do what is shown on the next slide, number 9. This certainly is a beautiful park. It's, I guess this one's in Holland. When I look at this as an ecologist, I say, you know, there's flowers there's shrubs there's trees. It's lovely. But this is not restoration ecology. This is gardening. This is a landscape which takes an enormous amount of money and energy and people power to keep it looking like this. It's not something which functions by itself. In fact, if I went back to this park in 20 or 30 years, it would probably look exactly the same. The trees would be a little bit bigger. Maybe those tulip colors will have changed. But there'd be no dynamic, no function. There wouldn't be birth and death. If any of these trees died, believe me, the park managers would replace them in the same kind in the same place. There's no seedlings on the ground. I'm sure everything would be mowed down if a seedling from one of those trees appeared. And even the animal community is irrelevant to a park like this. Oh, sure, there'll be birdies singing in the trees, but birds carrying in seeds, bees pollinating those tulips, this is irrelevant to the functioning of a high-design landscape park. There's photosynthesis going on. It's certainly a public amenity. But life and death and change, the things which define the healthy, natural community, are not there. And I'm not interested in this as part of restoration ecology. And, of course, those of us who deal with public lands and public budgets and public grants don't have long-term budgets to maintain a landscape like this. Restoration really plays a major role in situations where there might be some money up front for closure, for construction budget, but nothing for long-term operation and maintenance. And in that sense, it's of real value across this country where public budgets are so stressed and so tight. And that's encouraged me to try to get more of this restoration approach into the public sphere. Please go to the next slide. This is the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area. And I like it because it gives a typical view of what's happening all around the world. We live in an urbanized world. Most people live in cities now throughout the world. I was at a meeting recently in Europe where they said a city like London is not even a big city anymore on a worldwide basis. When you look at this picture, slide 10, most of it is sort of beige, and that represents us, our homes, our factories, our roads, the infrastructure that makes modern civilization. Natural habitats are just a few little green parcels here and there. That's what's left in public parks and preserves. Restoration ecology, it means to add back little spots of green, to add back these ecological services around where most people live. You know, nature isn't just where you go on your vacation to the Poconos or the Adirondacks. Nature is all around us, and we need it for quality of life and to save money for our homes and communities. If I can add back little patches of green, I serve the citizens in this area. I also make networks and passageways so birds can move up and down the continent during the Great Migrations. Without these patches, we stress our natural resources throughout the continent. Given this picture of the metro area, what can we do next? Well, let's go to slide 11. This aerial photo is a very small part of North New Jersey, and I like it because it shows a typical urban area. Right in the middle is a kidney-shaped area, which is an old municipal landfill. The roads around it are the New Jersey Turnpike and other roads just crisscrossing the area. Also in this slide are other bits of our industrial civilization. Additional landfills. On the upper left is a railroad yard. On the right side is a very, very dense community. And that wetland area in the lower area is not very good water quality, full of Phragmites, that weed which sweeps through our degraded wetlands. This, my friends, is not Yosemite National Park. This is what's around most of our big urban areas. What can we do here to make this functioning and more useful for our folks? Please go to the next slide, number 12. This is the same area close up. And what you see here is what's on a municipal landfill after about 20 years of being left alone. Those buildings in the background are part of the Newark downtown. What we see here is, of course, a terrible and impoverished soil. The original overburden of clean fill has long since washed away. The grasses without any maintenance have disappeared. You have just a few weedy species and one ailanthus, that alien tree in the middle. Its ecological services are terrible. Its wildlife habitat is terrible. And as a citizen of the state of New Jersey, I wouldn't want to go here for a hike or a jog. It's just ugly and useless. I like working on sites like this as a botanist because it gives me the potential to add back something. It's not pretty, but, you know, I'm trying to look ahead. What can we do with a site like this to try to make it functioning and healthy? And, of course, to me, it's like a lot of other abandoned or urban sites which has no budget for landscaping in the traditional sense, but really still has a potential. This site was about 20 acres. Well, the first thing you have to do is think about the soil. I can't get any kind of a healthy habitat, whether it's a meadow or a woodland, growing in this crushed glass. I sometimes say I'm an in vitro plant ecologist, so I'm planting in glass half the time. Well, what do you do to get soil on here? Urban soils generally are terrible. If it's not garbage and crushed glass and tires like this, it's very, very poor quality. The next slide, number 13, lists some of the characteristics of urban soils that we find all across this country. They're not healthy, normal, natural soil horizons. They've been changed by people's activities in the past. Land use for 300 years has been so complex during our population centers. This is what you get. Very dense, high bulk density soils. Air pollution has made it hydrophobic, so it sheds water rather than absorbing water. pH is inappropriately high. Very poor water drainage because of the physical properties of the soil. Nutrient cycling is terrible, and the soil organisms, which are critical for a healthy, aerated soil, are often missing. You know, a soil is not just dead, it's not just geology. It's full of microbes and fungi and small invertebrates that work the soil and mix it, breaking down things like twigs and leaves, enriching it over the decades. Many of our urban soils are lacking all that. They're not sterile, but they're not functioning and healthy. Over the years, sometimes there's even pollution from old industrial uses. That has to be dealt with in some remediation before we do the restoration ecology. And, of course, around population centers, the soil is hotter, and this changes the functioning of plants in these soils. So soil is the number one thing I think about before I start thinking about any of my beloved posies. What can you do on a site like this? Well, in the Meadowlands of Jersey, this site I've just showed you, we had to get some soil. Where do you go if you're a professor with no money and you need to cover 20 acres with about a yard of soil? You go to Manhattan. And we were able to build links between the construction industry and the restoration practice. This slide, number 14, shows a construction site in Midtown Manhattan. They were digging out for a foundation of a skyscraper. And Manhattan, of course, was once covered by a glacier. And this turned out to be the riverbed of an old glacial river. A very, very clean, sandy loam with no construction debris, no weed seeds. Good Lord, it had been buried for 13,000 years. The contractor normally would just have to take this and haul it away and dump it somewhere and pay a pretty tipping fee. We said, look, if you take all that dirt and you dump it on my landfill in New Jersey, you can dump it here for nothing. We saved the hauler about $200,000 in tipping fees. We got, for free, a huge amount of this healthy soil, and we could cover our site. And I can just encourage you all to try to build these bridges between the construction industry and those of us who manage sites that we're trying to improve. Well, this was a pretty good soil, but I still needed some organic matter. After all, there was not much carbon in this as the glacier melted. Where do you get organic matter to cover 20 acres if you have no money? You go to Teaneck, New Jersey. And there on the next slide, number 15, you see me, getting very dirty, waiting as composted leaf mulch from this local township got dumped on my site. Many of our suburban city communities and our cities are collecting yard waste and composting it. This is material that you can often get to enrich soils for restoration. And usually it's available for a trivial cost. In many communities, biosolids, cleaned and processed sewage waste can also be used to add organic matter. Other areas can get leaf paper mulch, and this also can be used at low cost to enrich soils before we think about what's the appropriate plant communities. Well, this stuff was spread upon my site, and then I could move on. So first we start with a healthy soil, thinking about what kinds of endpoints or target communities we want to install, and then we start talking about plants. And I think I just want to pause here for a second to see if we have any questions. Oh, excuse me, there's one other slide I want to show you folks. If you go to number 16, this shows one of our assistants looking at a tree on one of these landfills that had a very, very thin layer of final cover over the cap. I'm so often asked by engineers and land managers, look, I'm interested in putting some pretty trees and shrubs down, but won't the roots go through a cap? Won't they challenge my cap and ruin my site? And the answer is, we found, no, this virtually never happens. This one picture shows a site that only had about 4 or 5 inches of soil over a very high bulk density clay cap. In these conditions, the roots of these trees, when they reach the cap, spread sideways. A baby root is microscopic with root hairs. This has a very low pushing strength. They turn and they go sideways, staying in the soil above the cap. And whether the site is closed with a geomembrane or with a clay cap, these are not going to be challenged by roots. We've had to actually publish some studies on this, and those references are available in the links at the end of the slide presentation. And for those of you who have those concerns, you can look there. The state of New York first said, you won't let you put trees on a landfill. But after we did these studies, they ended that regulation, and now in many, many sites in the state of New York, this kind of restoration ecology is going on to great public appeal. Jeff, I'd like to stop here to see if there's any questions just about this ground stuff that I've been chatting about before we move on to restoring plant communities.
Thank you, Stephen. What I'd like to do is bounce back and forth between the simulcast questions and the folks on the phone. There will be opportunities, around slide 41 as well, to interject additional questions.
Yeah, and then at the end we'll have more time too. But just about these particular things, if there's any specific question, I wouldn't mind answering a few now.
All right. So for the folks on the phone, feel free to take your phones off mute. All we ask is that you identify yourself and where you're calling from, and also that you don't be bashful. Anyone? Well, let me look over to the simulcast questions. Again, I encourage the phone participants not to be bashful and take advantage of the fact that Dr. Handel's here with us today. We do have a question from, or more of a comment, I guess, from Virgil in Booz Allen Hamilton in San Antonio, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He said, slide 13, you said urban soil is inappropriately high pH, and this is, you mean basic as opposed to acidic soil.
But well, they're more basic than they should be. Most native woodlands are in soils that are a pH of about 5.5 to 6.5. We found around urban centers, for a lot of reasons, the pH is much, much higher, 8 or 9 even sometimes. But even a 7 or 8 is too high for healthy growth of most of our woodland trees. These soils can be remediated in rather simple ways. We're used to putting lime down on soils that are too acid, but you can also add a molecular sulfur down to lower pHs. So these things can be remediated quickly, and it should be looked at before you think about putting in a large plant community.
Again, I would just like to open it up to anyone on the phone. If you have a question, just identify yourself and where you're calling from.
Hi, Dr. Handel. This is Jeff Stringer in Chicago.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment and a question. Wanted to follow up about the use of biosolids as a matrix for organic capacity. The Chicago Metropolitan Sanitary District has been using that same matrix for a while now and has a robust business selling that matrix as a organic feed. Do you have any papers that go to that topic?
We do have a lot of information on that. My colleague, Dr. Sally Brown from the University of Washington, is an expert on that, and she actually gives another course in this sequence where she talks in great detail about biosolids. I know through our EPA coordinators we've got a lot of paper resources and references that we can give you, and I guess maybe the protocol is Jeff, you have everyone's... We can add some of that as a link onto this presentation. Jeff, is that how we should do it?
Oh, exactly. Just for the folks that are on, we always have a links page associated with each seminar topic, and it stays pretty much in perpetuity with that. And, shortly after this session is over, this is the first time we've done it, we will match up the audio file with the slide set and put it in an archive on Cluin, and you'll be able to access it anytime, night or day.
All right, so we'll have some sources on references on biosolid use for land remediation. We have those references, and I'll keep bugging Jeff to make sure that gets online.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anyone else on the phones, feel free to take your phone off mute. Please identify yourself and where you're calling from.
Okay, Jeff, why don't I push on then with the next little sequence here?
We do have one quick question.
One quickie. Let's hear it from the audience.
Yeah, this is Scott Fredericks with EPA and with the Environmental Response Team, and I've been working with Dr. Handel on this course. He mentioned earlier this is part of what was originally like a 3-day course that included a site visit. We're going to offer next on this set of internet seminars a part of the course that deals with use of compost and primarily composted biosolids for both for restoration work and to remediate soils that are contaminated with metals. And we'll put some links on the end of this seminar to the work that's been done by Dr. Rufus Cheney at USDA. It's also in Sully Brown. And if you keep an eye out, we'll be advertising the second part of this course, which deals with the use of biosolids, which we've used extensively on mining sites. Thank you.
Okay. I think it's a good time to just keep moving on. I think we're going to be moving on to slide 17. And, Stephen, if you want to take over.
Okay, sure. We've got plenty of time. As long as I finish before 7 o'clock when the Yankee game starts, I'll be happy.
Yeah, well, they're out of it anyway.
Don't say that. Don't say that. Okay, folks, this little picture shows where we've done a lot of our research work and demonstration work. It's the Fresh Kills landfill in Staten Island, New York City. This is was the largest landfill in North America, almost 3,000 acres, and it's where almost all the solid waste of the city of New York went since World War II. If you go to the next slide, you see what the site looks like. It's really a moonscape. It's just terrible. Everything here above the water, which is salt water, is household garbage. I'm standing on one of the mounds, which is about 130 feet high, and there are four of those mounds in the complex. I was asked by the City of New York, hey, we want to take this site, and when we finish using it, we want to make a public park. Can you help us? And I, of course, said, sure, why not? And here we go. What do you do with a site like this, which is just awful? There's no ecological history. The soil is not natural. There's no seeds or rootstocks in the ground. It's in one of the biggest population centers in our country, so we want to do something in the public service here. What can you do? To landscape, like you would around your corporate headquarters, this site of 3,000 acres would cost a fortune, and we don't have a fortune. So using ecological links and ecological processes, we thought we may be able to slowly cover this ground with healthy, useful habitat at a modest, relatively modest cost to the people in this community. The site, of course, Fresh Kills, was hated by the people of New York. Of course, it was 3,000 acres of garbage with trucks and barges coming in and so on. Please go to the next slide, 19. A very sad but interesting story occurred after the great attack in New York City. All the debris from the great towers had to be taken somewhere. And the only place to put it was at Fresh Kills Landfill, which had the infrastructure to handle a year's worth of debris coming in barges from Manhattan. And as this debris was taken there, of course the steel was recycled, but everything else was just dumped at Fresh Kills. And instead of being a reviled site, Fresh Kills became effectively a cemetery, of course, because ashes from the people who were murdered were part of the debris. And the interest in making Fresh Kills beautiful and a memorial grew instantly. And our work in restoration suddenly got great impetus because folks said, what can we do here to honor the innocent people who were murdered? And suddenly my work, instead of just being he's the guy who works on garbage, became what can he do to make this site appropriate given the sacrifice? In this way, restoration really did serve the public interest in a profound way. Let's go to slide 20, the next one. One of our first studies at Fresh Kills was just to ask the very simple question in terms of ecological process. Look, you know, we have these landfills. They've already closed part of it. They put grass seed in, hydroseeding it, to keep the soil from eroding. Again, the normal engineering approach. What can we do cheaply and quickly to get back some healthy, low-maintenance habitat? And the first step was I said, look, let's just put seeds in the ground of native plants. And this little experimental plot with little white pot labels shows an area where we put in seeds of about 25 kinds of native plants, woody plants, that are typical of young forests or shrublands or a farm that's been abandoned for 10 years. And we just asked the question, if we know exactly how many seeds went in, how will they do? Maybe this is the quickest, cheapest way to do it. Go to the next slide, 21. The data for this experiment couldn't be simpler. We just went to each of these little labels. We knew exactly how many seeds had gone there and of what species. And we counted the number of seedlings that came up. These, of course, are oak seedlings from acorns. And we went through this. The results were remarkable and terrible. The next slide, number 22, shows what happened in the first 3 years. What we found was that of the 25 some odd species we put in, most of them had no seedlings at all after 3 years. This slide shows the winners, the ones that had some germination and emergence in the first 3 years. Let's just quickly go through this. Aronia, chokeberry, a lovely shrub. 1,250 seeds planted. After 3 years, one measly seedling. Celtis, hackberry, a tree which grows very well in dry soils. That was pretty good. About 20% of the seeds made seedlings. The next two corners are dogwoods. Look at that. 1%. 0.5%. Spicebush or Lindera, 0.5%. Quercus alba is a white oak, 27%. That big acorn did pretty well. And the final one, Rus, is a sumac. Again, 2% of the seeds made seedlings. This was devastating. And what we learned from this is simply that restoration ecology is whole cloth. It's not just, oh, we know what plants should grow in a sunny, early successional site. You've got to get the soil right. You can't just hydroseed with grasses. Those grasses are terrible competitors for a woody seedling. They just can't make it against those woody plants, grasses. So when you think about restoration, you can't come in later as a botanist or ecologist and say, oh, here's a site that some engineering outfit closed 5 years ago. It's very, very hard. At the beginning of the closure, at the beginning of the discussions of end use, you've got to have a qualified ecologist involved to talk about what quality of soil, what kind of soil, how should we retard erosion, and it shouldn't be with fescues. It should be with other kinds of native clump grasses, which give room for these woody things to move in. And then you can get the process going. So it's something that has to be part of the original planning, just as so many other aspects are with public input, transportation, and so on. Next slide, number 23, these pretty little red berries. Knowing that I didn't have the funds, and who in the world does, to plant 2,000 acres, I said, what link of nature can we use to help landscape this site? And, of course, the cheapest landscape contractors are the birds. So many of our trees and shrubs have these sorts of fleshy fruits, which birds eat, fly away, and then deposit the seeds, either through the front end or the back end, and the seeds get into the soil. And I asked the question, maybe we can get the bird community to play a role in enriching this site ecologically. And we did that by trying to get birds to come into the site and carry seeds about. Now, of course, these landfills, which are just normally mowed grass and worse, are not places where you get many birds visiting. Why should a healthy bird go to a place like this? There's nothing to eat. There's no place to nest. There's no place to perch to keep away from your enemies. It's a moonscape for birds also. So to get this link in nature reestablished, we said, let's try by putting in some clusters of native trees to try to seduce birds to come back to these degraded sites. Please go to number 24. This very simple graph shows the general picture of birds carrying seeds and where they go. There are no numbers on these axes, but the idea is straightforward. The parent plant on the left is the mother, the one that makes the seeds. Typically, for most species that have been looked at, most seeds fall very close to the mother plant, the parent plant. The line falls quickly and then levels off to an asymptote. Usually that break is at about 15 meters, 10 to 15 meters. The solid line shows wind-dispersed seeds, and where a wind-dispersed seed falls, of course, is a function of the size of the seed, the shape of the wing, and the wind speed. But most of those seeds fall very close to where they're made. Bird-dispersed seeds also stay pretty close. They come out of the bird real fast. But occasionally you get some seeds that come out further away from the mother plant. And that's what those two dotted humps are. That's when the birdie has gone to a tree to perch or to a nest to feed their young, and the seeds come out there. They're called, an ecological jargon, recruitment foci, but that's the idea. It's a place far from where the seed was made where we can get a concentration of seeds to start the next generation if the soil and soil surface is appropriate. How can I get this link in nature reestablished? Please go to 25. This shows a team of our students putting in a cluster of native trees on one of these empty landfill sites. As you see, surrounded is just weeds and almost nothing, although we have fixed up the soil. This is, in this case, is about 25 plants of native trees that produce a lot of fruit quickly to make the attraction to the bird community as high as possible. Go to the next slide, please. Our big experiment at Fresh Kills included these seven species in Latin and in English. And as you can see, they're relatively common plants of the eastern U.S., and there are analogous plants all over this continent. They all produce berries to attract birds, and they all make a lot of fruit even when they're young. The last thing I wanted was a tree that had to be 20 years old before it made any seeds at all. I'd be sitting there twiddling my thumbs. It wouldn't be a pretty picture. But these would work. So these are the plants we put in at Fresh Kills. Please go to 27. Native plants you can get more and more commonly now at commercial nurseries. The interest in restoration is growing internationally, and many of the big commercial nurseries have a nice listing of native plants that you can choose among. There's also smaller boutique nurseries that specialize in native plants all over our country. On the links at the end of this presentation, you'll see a website for the Society for Ecological Restoration, SER. And that website is a way to, as an entree, to find where native plants are available in your own communities and states. Also, the Society is a clearinghouse for local experts who you could call to ask, what are the appropriate plants for where I live, whether it's Chicago or San Antone or Orange County, California. Using those kinds of local resources of botanists and ecologists, you can put together a design. Many landscape architecture companies also do have folks who are knowledgeable about native plants and can advise your outfit or your agency and what would be an appropriate target. We call it the target community for restoration. Please go to 28. This is one of our demonstrations, and I do want to go through this a little because it gives us a series of principles that I think are important to go through. Look at all these dots. This is not me with the chicken pox. Each of these circles represents a cluster of native plants that I planted at that huge Fresh Kills landfill. And I asked the question and say, look, I have a budget from a municipal agency, and I want to cover a big piece of land with something that's better than mown grass that I have to spend money on a contractor to mow every month or so. What's the best way to spend my money? What's the best way to make this sustainable and spreading over the years? Should I put in many small clusters or a few big clusters? In other words, are there scale-dependent ecological processes that I have to think about to make sure my site's going to be healthy and sustainable over the decades? So in this particular demonstration, we put in 20 patches of four, altogether four sizes. Five patches that were small, seven plants. Five patches, 21, 542, 570. These were just seven species I planted, so it represents one plant of each species, or three, or six, or 10 plants of each species. And we just watched them. What happened? How were they served? How did the plants perform? And could we then go back to the public agencies and say, when you have a degraded site or a site where you want to bring back habitat for the public good, this is the best way to do it with a limited budget. And let me show you some of the results. Please go to 29. Here's a picture of one of our mid-sized clusters, so 21 plants, on that Fresh Kills landfill slope. Again, please appreciate the landscape matrix around this. Highways, tank farms, industrial zones. This is not, again, Yosemite National Park. This is in one of the...
Stephen, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Somebody is interrupting the call. Please put your phone on mute. Hit star 6 now. Thank you.
Thanks, Dad. That was very helpful. Okay, folks, so we're looking at this slide number 29. And what we've done here is under the trees, we've put in a little seed trap. It's just a one-yard square piece of canvas. And if any birds come to these trees and deposit seeds, they fall into the trap. And we went through each trap to see, well, in fact, are birds coming to the site, bringing in seeds from elsewhere? And does it make a difference whether we have a small patch or a middle or a large-sized patch? Which functions best in terms of long-term biodiversity and enhancement of the site? And I really didn't know what to expect, and I didn't expect much given this landscape of this industrial zone around where I was working. The next slide, number 30, please. This shows the kind of data we were collecting. In the traps, we would find middens of seeds. And just as leaves of each species are different and flowers of each species of a plant are different, the seed shape and size are different. And there are manuals, and with some botany training, you can actually know what kind of plant each seed came from. And so we went through this to see, you know, what was the story? With this link in nature, birds bringing in species and seeds that may become individuals, could that happen in the biggest urban area in our country? Next slide, 31, please. The results were really remarkable. I had hoped at the beginning of the study we might get a couple of hundred seeds in the traps. We had 65 traps, 65 square yards, actually square meters to be technical. We found in the first fall we had over 14,000 seeds deposited in these traps from about 20 species. What's listed on this slide 31 are the main species, none of which I had planted. These are all seeds that were carried into my site from somewhere in Staten Island and deposited on site. 14,000 seeds. This was more of a success than I ever could have dreamt. So this link in nature, birds as unpaid landscape contractors bringing in thousands of seeds that have the potential to make new woody plants, can occur even in this kind of a degraded site. If we were closer to source plants and healthy habitats, ostensibly this total would even be higher. The last line where it says outside plots are my control traps, which were just set in the open grassland where I hadn't put in my trees. And you see the number there is modest. It's just 14. These birds are not stupid. They don't go sitting on the grass. There's nothing for them to do, and of course it's dangerous. There might be snakes in the grass. So it's these clusters, even small ones, of trees that attract birds, and that's where the seeds end up, in and around these plots. Let's go to 30. The next one is 32. Well, this is just a listing of the genera of plants that came into my traps in the first few years. Please forgive that it's in Latin, but I am a professor. These are things, most of which you would like in your natural woodlots on the east coast of America. If I went down the first list in English, it would say things like a shad blow, a porcelain berry, Hercules club, bittersweet, hackberry, dogwood, Russian olive, holly, juniper, spice bush, tulip tree, honeysuckle, crabapple, huckle, whatever, and then the last one is America bayberry. Most of these are plants we would want in a healthy habitat, but some are not. Even in the first year, we would get some plants in which are alien invasives, things which are very dangerous for long-term sustainability of our habitats. And I have to just have an aside about that. If you'll go to the next slide, number 33, this is a snapshot of Celastris bittersweet. This is a terrible vine. It originally was introduced into our country from Asia. It has beautiful orange berries in the fall. I guess that's why it was brought in. But this is a plant which has no natural enemies in North America, and it sweeps through our woodland. It's the kudzu of the north. And it'll cover up canopy trees like this, and of course in a few years kill them because they can't photosynthesize. Then the tree dies, the celastris spreads to the next tree, and after several years, what was a healthy city park or a healthy woodlot becomes a monoculture of this invasive with very poor wildlife value. Invasive plants are a major problem in our public lands throughout North America, and they must be challenged by management and understanding even at the beginning of a study. The fact that I found seeds of this celastris even in the first year was a warning sign that I need some modest management to look for these things at all stages of a restoration. And all our city park managers are well aware of this problem and are starting slowly to deal with it. The next slide, number 34, please. This showed in the first year which six invasives we did find in site after just 1 year. Those of you from the East Coast and even from the Midwest know these to be regional problems, and they all must be engaged and attacked to keep our natural landscapes alive. As an aside, even those of us who manage public parks are aware of them, because a lot of these plants are invading land which we consider saved or preserved. Well, that's just not true. Even our public parks, which can't be built on in terms of development, are challenged by these things, and we need more management than we ever thought we would. And finally, in this little aside on invasives, if you'll go to number 35, I did a study of habitats in the city of New York over the last 100 years, and what we found, using historical botanical records, is that in the last 120 years, all major habitat types are being more and more attacked by alien invasive species. Lowland forests, dry soil forests, coastal zones, wet and dry meadows. In every habitat type, alien species are becoming more and more prevalent, crowding out native diversity, crowding out ecological services. This is something, alas, we all as citizens, as well as land managers, have to come to grips with. It's part of land stewardship, which is all of our duties as citizens. So it's something, I never say if you do restored woodlands, you'll have no management. I say it's less management than if you're mowing and fertilizing every damn year, but it's still something that you've got to keep an eye on. Okay, let's go back to the main story. Slide 36, please. Well, look, I learned that woody plants can grow on these thin landfill soils. I learned that birdies would come back bringing in seeds of many other species. The next question in terms of ecological process is, look, will these plants really reproduce on site? Can we make seeds on site so in the long term thousands more seeds are being made and spread about to fill up space and replace plants that are eaten or died? So the story there is pollination. Wood plants on these degraded urban post-industrial sites really attract bees and make seeds. We don't think about bees much until they bother us as humans. But of course, it's a critical part of a healthy living forest. So we went to our experimental plantings to see, would we get visits by many bee species? Would we make seeds on the plants that we installed? Please go to 37, please. And with some students who became quick experts on bee biology, we found a really very optimistic story. After 3 years on this landfill, the biggest in North America, we found over 60 species of wild bees coming to the flowers. And more to the point, the same number of flowers made seeds, set seeds, as control sites in natural habitats elsewhere. So even though this was degraded land, there were enough bee species that wandered in, visited the flowers, and made seeds, so that reproductive step, which is so critical, could occur on these sites. Where'd the bees come from? Well, I think actually they were probably living in suburban gardens and vegetable patches, hanging on until this new resource of my plantings became available. We learned that some of these bee species are vagabonds, they're travelers, and they'll forage widely looking for nectar, and they would come to restored sites even in this industrial part of the city of New York. So pollination and seed set and production does occur even in these very stringent sites. Number 38, please. Ooh la la, this bar graph shows another story, and it's a warning story. This shows the results of that seed set and seed trap study over the first 3 years. And let me just walk you through the black bars on the left side. The first bar from 94 is the data I've already showed you. Over 14,000 seeds deposited in my traps that year. And then on the right, the gray bar shows it's about 36 species we found. A great success story. We were jumping up and down, even on the landfill. The next year was a regional drought, and my plants didn't die, but throughout the whole region, it was a terrible year to make seeds. The plants were wilting and stressed, and most of the seeds and fruits were shriveled. And no surprise, we get less than half the number of seeds, about 6,000 seeds, in those same traps. But the number of species remained high, over 30 that second year. The third year was great. It was perfect, wet, sunny weather all summer. I thought once again we'd get a pulse of massive amounts of seeds in our traps. But incredibly, the amount of seeds stayed relatively low, about 5,000 seeds, even though the number of species stayed about 21 or so. What happened in that third year, 96, even though the weather was so great? Well, what happened was a landscape issue, which sobered me about the problems of restoration ecology. Please go to number 39. This picture shows the total slope of Freshkills near some of my plantings. And right outside the landfill was this little remnant forest, oh, maybe about 3 acres. Folks, this was not any rare or endangered species. This was your typical little urban woodlot of ashes and some maples and some vines. Nothing really special. Now, this is not a wetland, so it's not protected by state or local law. There's no rare or endangered species there, so it doesn't fall into those federal categories. And it's not a tidal area, so we don't have the tidal laws. It's a typical upland of common species, which, generally speaking, is not protected at all. And yet, for restoration ecology, these little urban remnants are critically important. What had happened for me was that in the third year, about half, or a little bit more than half, of this site was cut down to make a strip mall for Staten Island. We really needed another strip mall. But without those trees and birds there, we had no source of transporters, the birds, nor seeds that were being produced by these plants to be carried out to my site. So for long-term restoration in our urban and suburban areas, these little remnant areas are unbelievably valuable, even though they're given, by and large, no legal protection at the moment. So as we think about these patches, let's not forget they offer value for the future for our habitats and ecological services, the kinds of things those folks in those houses behind the woodlot really need for a healthy human existence down the line. And we have to find some way as citizens to making sure that value isn't forgotten. Let's go to the next one, number 40. Well, look, I've been at this for about 8 years on this particular site, and things are doing pretty well. All the patches that I planted are growing. We found that birds would come and deposit seeds at all 20 patches, even the small ones. They didn't seem to mind the small ones. They still went there. And after several years, the patches are getting wider and wider as these trees and shrubs grow out, clonally through new offshoots and through new seedlings around it. And from the road, dare I say it, it looks almost natural. Since the city is not mowing around my patches, we're now getting some wildflowers being blown in, things like goldenrods, whose seeds will be carried across roads. And bit by bit, this site is starting to look like an abandoned farm, not like the largest landfill in North America. So I think it's possible, and I think it's useful. But we're not really done yet. You know, this was just phase one, getting the soil right, starting the process of putting in native trees, getting birds and bees back, and so on. There's more to this if we really want a full spectrum of biodiversity in our habitats. Please go to 41. This snapshot shows the forest floor and then eastern forest in the spring. In a mature forest, of course, it's shady, and the soil is reasonably rich after decades of dead leaves being deposited and decomposing. And the woodland flora in the eastern United States, of course, is a riot of colors and species. What you're seeing here is mostly white trilliums, but there's so many other species here. Violets and trilliums and uvulare, rather, bellworts, and many, many other things. How can we get these plants into a restored site? Well, these are all plants which require shade and a rich soil. And we don't have shade at the beginning of a restoration. The stuff we plant, the shrubs and the trees, is small. We have to find a way through regulation and management of budget of going back to these sites several years later, what I call phase two. Then adding back those species whose requirements, physiologically and in terms of other adaptations, require them to be in a cooler, shadier habitat. Only then will we have the full spectrum of a healthy forest. Turns out these spring wildflowers are very important. They act as dams for nutrients during the spring rains, so you don't get the nutrients washed out of the soil into our river courses and waterways, eutrophying them. The nutrients are sucked up by the spring flowers, and then as they die back in the summer, the nutrients are released and they're sucked up by the trees who are active during the summer months. So it's a very nice ecosystem process. So how in the world do you get these spring flowers back in the site? Good Lord, their seeds are not carried by the wind. nor by birds. By and large, most of our spring flowers here in the East are carried by ants. Please go to slide 42. Here's a snapshot in my lab of one species, Dutchman's britchers, a rather common wildflower in our eastern forests, and it shows you the story. On the left are the little seeds. They're only about 3 millimeters across. And each black seed has on it some white tissue, which is full of fats. And what happens in ecology is that an ant will find this on the forest floor, pick it up, and carry it back to the nest. At the nest, they eat off the white fatty parcels, feed their babies in their nest, and then throw out the seed unharmed. And that's what you see on the right side of the slide, Dutchman's britcher seeds, where the fat's been removed and these seeds were deposited in the ant nest garbage pile. The seed is then dispersed, and the plant can start to grow unharmed as a new seedling. It's just like you and I eating an apple and then throwing the core of the apple with its seeds out through the window of your Honda Accord, or if you're a professor, through the window of your Ferrari. It's the same evolutionary story, but on the forest floor, it's carried out by ants, not by big mammals like us. How are we going to get these wildflowers back? You know, you can't get an ant carrying a seed like this across the Jersey Turnpike. It just won't happen. The only way to do it is to get part of your team, or the land managers, whether it's public or private, to go back after 10 years and reintroduce the species that have to come in after the soil's changed and shade is on the ground. So restoration ecology is a process. It's not just something you can write out during the first fiscal years and say, we are done. And this is something that we have to come to grips with also. Please go to the next slide, 43. Jeff, before I start going through just a couple of case studies, I wouldn't mind stopping now to see if there's any particular questions about the plant aspect of this, if that's okay with you.
It's fine. I was kind of expecting it. Again, let's open it up to the phone lines. If anybody has a question for Dr. Handel, please just identify yourself and let us know where you're calling from. Again, I remind you.
Oh, I put them all to sleep, Jeff. I'm in trouble.
Yeah. Time not to be bashful here. Anyone?
Well, I'm going to ask a question of myself then, just to get this going. You know, one of the problems we find with public contracts that are offered to engineering companies or through public agencies that get grants from the states or the feds is that very often the budget has to be spent during a certain fiscal year, like make sure you spend all your construction zone money or fulfill all your contracts by July 1st. And this, of course, is a real problem when I say, look, you know, we can't plant everything at once, or we have to wait till the soil is improved, and we can't put some of the plants until next spring. And we found in New York and in New Jersey, there are ways to put riders into these contracts, so a certain amount of the money can be reserved to be spent in the next fiscal year. It's put into escrow or some other legal ways, and the contractor then knows they can come back in year two or year four and get access to that modest amount to complete the job during the ecologically appropriate time. It's not like, you know, hard type engineering where everything can be done as soon as you get the equipment and the people power there. Sometimes you have to go by seasons and you've got to wait till the hydrology is right. And if you talk to the local municipal or agency attorneys, you'll find there are ways of reserving money for phase two and phase three, even if the money is coming from a foundation or from a federal budget grant. And I would encourage people, as you start doing this kind of thing, to think in terms of the biological needs, not just that the contractor wants to get everything done as soon as possible to get their bonds back and so on. There's a certain ecological imperative that has to be put in. Often the trustees of projects, such as Superfund projects, are aware of this and will help participate in keeping some funds put aside for when certain ecological or restoration steps has to occur. And it's not a problem. It's just something that has to be thought about and managed as part of the project administration.
Well, Stephen, I've got a few questions that have come in over the Internet, and then
good.
Give the phone folks another shot. The first one's actually a comment, and it comes from Greg Dukowski, Delaware Department of Natural Resources. regarding biosolids and soil reuse. He said, be careful what you use. We're currently remediating what was a slag disposal site with metals that was covered with sewage sludge to remediate it. Unfortunately, the sludge contained PCBs.
Oh, absolutely. Everything has to be analyzed before use. An appropriate agency, and of course EPA would always do this, would characterize each source. From certain sites, there are heavy metals or other kinds of pollutants, and you can reject those on site.
Mm-hmm.
Others are cleaner, depending on the municipality and the source of the material, and they're just fine. Also remember, a lot of these sites are not going to be used for a public playground for Joe and Josie. They're going to be used like a landfill site for much more modest public use. So the regs determining what levels of materials can be tolerated are different depending on the use. The residential use, of course, is the highest quality. But by looking about, you can find biosolids which will fulfill the legal and public health requirements you need. But absolutely, you've got to characterize the site before you accept it.
And for those other participants that are either in Delaware or are going to be working in Delaware, Greg went on to say that their agency has developed a soil reuse policy to try to avoid problems of that sort. We have another question that's come in from Miles Constable, Environment Canada, up in Edmonton. At Fresh Kills, how much soil was first brought in to reestablish the soil plots?
Oh, great. Yeah, that's important. I guess I should have mentioned that. I'm often asked, how deep a soil should you have? A typical sanitary landfill closure is about 2.5 feet in this part. That really is enough soil to support a reasonably healthy forest. You know, throughout, certainly in eastern Canada and in New England, you pass through road cuts, and you'll get soil that's only about a foot, foot and a half deep, which supports a healthy forest that could be 80 feet tall. It's the quality of the soil more than the depth. Having said that, the more soil, the better, because the more soil you have, the greater the reservoir of soil moisture during the dry summer months. We aim for about 3 feet of soil. If we can get 3 feet of reasonably specked out soil, we feel we have enough of a base to support a healthy woodlot for long term, knowing that decade after decade, that soil is going to be enriched by leaf litter and compost and so on. So 3 foot is ideal. If they say you could only have enough money or material for 2.5 feet, I would accept that too. Just when you think about the target, what species you're putting in, don't put in species that require a lot of water. Water stress is the greatest problem on these slopes.
Miles actually submitted a second question related, and I think you may have covered it here. How much soil depth would be required over a landfill with a tight clay cap to reestablish deeply rooted trees like oak, elm, and poplar? 3 feet?
2.5, 3 feet. I have to say, deeply rooted trees is not really an accurate thing to say. These trees, if there are deep, soft soils, will put down roots deeply. But if there's only 2 feet of soil over a hard cap, whether it's clay or a geomembrane, those oak roots will not go down deeply. They'll stay in those top 2 feet. The true profile of a tree is a big crown and then the roots as a pancake in the top layers of soil. It's not a dumbbell where the root mass mirrors the crown of the tree, the top of the tree. Often I know we were all taught that in grade school. It's just not true. Soil, roots are plastic, and they'll stay in the favorable, healthy soil that has air, water, and nutrients. They don't keep pushing down through a cap, which is unfavorable microhabitat. So deeply rooted is only true where the soil is deep and soft. If the soil is shallow with a hard pan, whether it's bedrock or a geomembrane, those roots stay in the top several inches of the top foot. They're not deeply rooted. We have oak trees that are 20 feet tall on our sites now, and we know the roots are in the top 15 inches.
I'd like to open it up to people on the phone lines one more time here.
Jeff, one other thing. In the references, again, at the end, there's a few papers on roots and soils, and this is much data and specific information about that is given. For those of you who require that information, to get a permit to pursue these lines, and just want a greater understanding.
All right, thank you, Stephen. Again, folks on the phone, give you an opportunity to chime in. Please identify yourself and where you're calling from.
I'm Charles Brigance with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality and with their Natural Resource Trustee Program. What's your opinion of high-density planning and hoping for an adequate percentage of survival, especially in arid areas, dry areas?
Yeah, thanks. We've done some work in arid soils in California and elsewhere. And a lot of these sites, even with some of the strip mines out west, what folks like to do is put in a lot of younger trees, which are much, much cheaper than getting big B&B stock, of course, and then knowing that some will die. There's a lot of ways to do this in arid areas to facilitate success, like putting little mycorrhizal pellets in the soil to increase the fungi, which help the plants suck up nutrients and water. In terms of managing a budget, one way to do it is to put many small things in, knowing some will make it in certain microsites that are more favorable, and others will just fade away. Putting in bigger material is often not the best thing to do. There have been some very careful studies show that smaller plant material sometimes survives better and then ends up being bigger 5 years, 10 years down the line than bigger stuff that's installed up front. Because at the nursery, if you dig up a big shrub or a 2-inch caliper tree, the transplant shock is enormous because you're chopping off a lot of the roots when you dig it out of the ground and boil it up. So smaller plants sometimes will do better, and they're much easier on your budget. We tend to put in smaller plants where the public doesn't mind that. Very often you'll have a situation where the general public wants something showy and lovely right away, and maybe close to the entrance or close to the parking lot, we'll put in a few bigger things, but further back, we put in smaller stock and just say, native forest underway. And I think people with a little bit of education will accept that. So denser plantings of smaller things are generally what I recommend, just as you've suggested.
Well, thank you, Texas. Anyone else? Again, feel free to take your phones off mute and ask questions. Anyone? We do have another one over the Internet. This comes from Melvin Landry down in Baton Rouge. And, Melvin, you know, our hearts go out to you down there. How extensive is your cooperation with individuals from other fields, such as engineers, hydrologists, et cetera?
Well, I always say not all civil engineers are hopeless. It's been fascinating to me as a trained ecologist and botanist to work with folks from other professions. I generally get very, very good cooperation from environmental scientists and hydrologists. Civil engineers are such hardworking, dedicated people. Their training, of course, is in stasis, keeping sites healthy and the same for long periods of time. The sign of success in engineering, if I can say this, is to build something and make sure it's going to last for 200 years. In ecology, success often means things will keep changing. And success means that I could put in 1,000 trees and shrubs today, but 50 years from now, they all might be dead, replaced by others. And that, to me, is a sign of ecological success and function and dynamic. So it's a sort of a different mindset. But I think as I do more and more restoration, folks have become to understand that a living community like this has enormous bioengineering value. You know, on these landfills, there's so much concern about leachate and trapping it and controlling it and stopping precipitation from getting into the solid waste. If I can put in a normal woodlot, 30% of the precipitation disappears from the site through transpiration and evaporation. The woody trees end up as an engineering solution to complement the leachate treatment system, which is being installed for millions of bucks by and large. So more and more, I think the two professions are learning to work together. The engineers have the sites that I'm desperate to work on to cover them with something useful, and I think we have some living tools which can cut the maintenance budget through the years and also give a way to control runoff and leachate, which is such a desperate problem for the civil engineering community. So I think these links are growing more and more, and of course training sessions like this help a lot.
Anyone else on the phone lines who has a question? Again, just identify yourself and where you're calling from. And we're getting some feedback buzz. If you're not going to ask a question, please phone on mute or hit *6 now, please. That took care of it. Thank you. I think, Stephen, it's time to move on. We're on slide 43, and we'll have one more session of questions and answers at the end of this.
Yeah, folks, I just wanted to give you just a few case studies to build your confidence that this really can happen. And let me just start local here. Slide, what are we up to, 43? This is a picture of a public park in the city of New York called Flushing Meadows. It's where the World's Fair was in the 60s, and it's where the hated Mets play these days. This was a site where I was asked to come in during a construction project to add a wetland. And you can see where it is. It's just sort of north of where Kennedy Airport is. So Kennedy is that big open gray area. Please go to the next slide, number 44. This was the site where the civil engineers had to put a new force main for a sanitary sewer pipe. And they had to dig down through the rubble, which was remains of the old World's Fair, and knock in the pipe, and then grade it flat. And I was asked, look, well, we're done with that. Can you add back some natural habitat? Because this is, after all, a city park, even though we have to have this pipe running through it underground. Please go to the next slide, 45. What we did is we very carefully graded it down to get the right hydrology. I mean, the water column is critical for these kinds of wetlands. And we made a series of these shallow pools adjacent to where the pipe was, and we planted thousands of herbs and also some woody plants also. And this little picture of the pond, what you see is actually several plant communities right next to each other. There's one in the standing water, there's other plants at the edge, there's other plants a few inches above the edge of the pond, and others where I'm standing taking this picture, which is really dry ground, because it's well drained a few inches above the pond. Different plant species have to go to each site along this gradient, and you need just someone trained in this kind of environmental science to do it properly. We knocked these in, and we went to see whether, in fact, we would get habitat growth and wildlife values. Please go to the next slide, number 46. Some subtleties occurred, too. We were actually able to put in, next to the lake in this park, a little patch of other soil quality. This is a sandy soil, which was just dumped in, and you could just get a couple of dump trucks or pickup trucks full of sandy soil to do this, as turtle habitat. Female turtles lay their eggs in soft, sandy ground. And by putting in a little patch like this at a trivial cost to the operation, you certainly have a microsite or a special habitat which can ensure the survival of the turtle population in this lake. So with a wildlife person involved, you can do little steps like this, which are easy and cheap and really have tremendous value for the local community. The next slide, 47, shows that pond about 3 years later, and it was pretty much a success. Many of the plants we installed were still there and spreading out. There were muskrats and ducks and herons on the pond. In the background, you see the Van Wyck Expressway going to Kennedy Airport. Again, it's not a national park. This is right in the middle of a huge industrial, urban center. The one problem is in the foreground, some of you will notice, that's some purple loosestrife. That's an invasive plant. It's a beautiful wildflower, but it will take over the site. We were able to help control that by introducing beetles, which eat only that plant, and that's under control now. And this has persisted. I just visited the site last year, and it's about 7 years old now, and it's doing just fine, thank you. Very little cost, long-term benefit, high wildlife value, and to a site which used to be just rubble and phragmites all over. So that's an urban wetland, a small parcel that could be done, and it was just a small percentage of the budget for putting in that force main. As you can imagine, it was about a $3 million job, and I think the restoration was about $110,000, including all the grading, planting, and so on. The next slide, please, number 48. This is a little different. This is a park which is just now getting started in the city of New York. It's being called the Brooklyn Bridge Park. It's on the East River of the city of New York, on the edge of Manhattan. The length of this park is about a mile and a half, big chunk of waterfront. It once was an active port facility, and it was like that for about 300 years. But after World War II, the port activity faded because they didn't have enough room for the container industry. And after a while, the Port Authority gave the land to the city, said, you can make a park out of it. We can't use it anymore. And that plan is advanced, as you'll see in a minute. What we're trying to do here is to restore a whole series of habitat types in this linear park. The total area is about 90 acres. But it faces Lower Manhattan and Wall Street. It's a spectacular place to be. What we want to do there in this park is to restore some submarine habitat, submarine grasses, and structure to get back mollusks and even oysters. This is great habitat for juvenile fishes, which then go out and enliven the harbor. We're going to have some salt marshes at the edge once we remove old bulkheads and old fill. We're going to have some woodlands and meadows, as you'll see in a minute, along the shore, and some areas of dune plantings out on one of those piers. The concrete will be removed and sandy soil put on that pier, and then dune plantings there for that habitat type. And we suspect this will be one of the most popular parks for the 3 million people who happen to live in Brooklyn. The scale of this, each of those piers is 300 foot by 800 foot in length. This is a big chunk of land, which is now going to be open to the public. The next slide shows what the land looks like now. There you go, an abandoned port facility. The city uses it just for warehousing now, because they got to do something with it. All that concrete and parking lot will be ripped up. Those warehouses will be removed. Soil remediation along the lines as we chatted about at Fresh Kills will occur here. And then all those habitat types will be approached. We're going to pick target communities very carefully because we're near salt water. That's the East River in this slide. So there'll be some salty winds. But there are many, many plant species which, of course, are adapted to living in our coastal zone. And those are the ones we're going to be using based on historic records. The next picture, number 50, is an artist's rendering of what the park could look like in really just a few years. The lead landscape architect is Michael Van Valkenburg Associates out of New York and Cambridge, Massachusetts, a very famous outfit. And they're very concerned about maximizing biodiversity and ecological services. And this is what that park could look like looking south. Salt marshes, kayakers, coastal woodlands, and meadows in the distance. It could be just beautiful instead of the abandoned park now. The next slide, number 51, is another project we got involved with in Beijing for the 2008 Olympics, the Summer Games. We submitted a restoration proposal with Sasaki Associates, the very famous design and planning company out of Boston. And this was the winning design for the Olympics. It's a huge site, as you can see from this picture. The southern part of it, the 700-acre athletic zone, so all the games will be. There's a central promenade and Olympic stadiums and swimming and so on. Above it, the city government of Beijing wanted a huge natural area, what they call the Forest Park. This will be about twice the size of Central Park in New York City, and will reinstate many, many of the native species of this part of Beijing that have been eliminated by the huge population growth of the city. If you'll please go to the next slide, 52. This is a close-up. And what you see is a big lake will be dug out. That soil will make a mound or small mountain on the northern part of the park. And then different forest types will be put on the mountain. We'll have meadows and shrublands near the lake, wet meadows along the lake, boating and educational facilities around the lake, and so on. To pick the species, we work with the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, which has great expertise of Chinese botany, and we found many, many species which can grow here and will restore the ecological services for the city, which is growing by leaps and bounds. It will be a magnificent backdrop to the games when they occur in the summer of 08. So starting in a landfill, I ended up with the Summer Olympic Games, and believe me, I didn't think I ever would be. But that's the potential of this approach. I'd like to end, please, with just a few warnings to all of you, what I'm calling constraints. Please go to slide 53, ecological constraints. My friends, I can't restore the forest primeval. I can't restore what North America looked like the day before Columbus landed. We're dealing with a highly modified environment and millions of people in our urban areas. We want to add back as much as possible, but we've got to be pragmatic. We're dealing with public funds and very often public lands. These are the things I keep in mind. Dispersal. It's very hard to get seeds naturally to move in, or even birds naturally to move in. I sometimes hear public officials say, oh, Stephen, leave it alone. Nature will come back. Well, this, my friends, is a lie. I mean, this is the Walt Disney approach to nature. You've got to manage these sites. You've got to encourage dispersal by starting populations, getting ways for birds to bring in other things. By itself, you're just going to end up with a moonscape. That's just the reality. Second, degraded plant and animal communities. We are surrounded by patches of nature which also are not typical. They're not normal. They've been changed, usually for the worst, by alien species, by people using it, by harvesting of the last 200 years of certain species, by kids on their motorbikes going through, crushing the soil, killing seedlings. They're not fully diverse communities. We've got to look to see what can we add, what's practical. Soil quality and biota, I've talked about too much. You've got to get the soil right first before you plant anything. And there's help with soil scientists and ecologists to work with you on that. Successional processes disturbances. You know, many of our natural communities aren't things which you just leave alone and they stay that way forever. They often need, out west, a fire. Or they need a disturbance so new seedlings can come up. You've got to find a way to find out what is the historic natural disturbance and how can we reiterate it on site so you get a natural ecosystem process. And finally, invasives. This is a problem throughout our country, throughout the world, to be honest. And we've got to find the ways with public land stewardship to control invasives or hope to get back our native biodiversity and all it has to offer us as citizens, healthy and forever. The next slide, 54, is regulatory constraints, the governmental and legal framework that we always work under. And I have to talk a little bit about this. Engineering goals are not the same as congruent to ecological goals. Again, it's one thing to say we want to cover the garbage and we know ways to cover the garbage. It's another thing to say we want the right kind of soil in so we can get a healthy meadow or woodlot here. It's one thing to say we want to get everything static and neat and clean. Ecology is not neat and clean. Ecology is a mosaic. It's a pastiche of different kinds of communities, some young, some old, and it's constantly changing. Both professions must work together, and I've learned through my experience that they certainly can for the public benefit. Rooting zone. Very often there's a regulation about what kind of soil should be specked out. Very often the rooting zone is designed for engineering needs. This often should be modified to make a healthy rooting zone for plants. Sometimes it's more soil, but sometimes it's just a different spec of the soil, a different pH, a different bulk density, as we've talked about. Next, disturbance regimes. The first time I was asked to put a meadow on a landfill, I said, of course I can do that, but how are we going to keep it a meadow in the long term? We either have to burn it occasionally or, you know, rake through it with a York rake every once in a while or disc it up to make new seedlings come in and to keep woodies from invading. And the government official I worked with said, you can't burn in New York City. It's against the air pollution rules. And he said, and, you know, you can't disc up a landfill. That's disturbing a landfill. It's against the state laws. So I said, look, meadows are non-equilibrium successional communities. They have to be disturbed. And he said, what are you talking about? Meadows will not persist. Meadows only exist where there's an occasional disturbance, whether it's a flood next to a river or a place where there's been a fire. If you leave a meadow alone, it becomes a woodland. This is an axiom of my science. So these things have to be worked in. They often can, but it takes education, collaboration, careful working through the regs. And finally, phasing of construction, as I've already talked about. Not everything can be done in year one or the first 18 months. Sometimes you've got to go back for ecological construction, and this has to be spelled out in the contract documents and with the management of the funding for the project. And let's go to the last slide, social constraints. You know, I'm a botanist, and I love plants, but my work is really with people more than it is with plants. And we're all human ecologists at one way or another. These are the things I've learned with dealing with the public and their representatives. First, beauty in the eye of the beholder. Look, I could think a woodlot is lovely, but not everybody does. I once put in a beautiful meadow, and the guy next to the meadow came to me and said, "Stephen, I hate it. Can you mow it down?" I said, "What are you talking about? It looks like a Monet painting. Look at those colors. Look at those flowers." And the guy said, "Stephen, I hate it. I can't play frisbee with my son here. It's too high, and it's got thorns." And you know, the guy was right. He couldn't play frisbee there. What I learned from that early example was that in dealing with land, you got to think about what the stakeholders want. I can put a meadow some areas, but good Lord, I've got to put mowed grass somewhere for folks to play catch, or to have a picnic, or to get a suntan. Beauty in the eye of the beholder means that the public interest is paramount. I can teach the importance of ecological services, but let's think about everything else that people want and fit it into the broader landscape. Second, different strokes for different folks. I could talk to them blue, and believe me, I have, on ecological services and why habitats are important for us, for people and our communities. But some people really want that strip mall, or they want a Costco, or they want a soccer field. And not every place is going to end up with a green reuse, meaning habitat. And again, I think habitat and restoration has a critical role in healthy communities of the future, but it's not going to be everywhere. And it's up to us as ecologists and stewards of the land to realize all the needs and fit those pieces of the land use jigsaw puzzle together. The numbers game. Not all plants and animals can live in small parcels. I can have a lot of fun with a 2-acre city lot to put something there, but I can't get everything there. There are rules about what species can live in small parcels. We know a lot about bird behavior. Some birds have territories, land that they have to have to hunt and to reproduce successfully. And sometimes those territories are huge, 50, 80 acres. I don't always have that. Same with plants. Not all plant species will live in 2 acres. They sometimes need moist, deep woods, the interior of forests, for those plants to live their successful life. Not all plants live where sun hits them a few hours of the day. So given the size of the parcel you're working on, this helps determine the target community, what you could get to be sustainable in long terms. "I want to be alone," the great Greta Garbo quote. This is a problem I've had in a lot of my projects. I go up full of smiles and great spirits and say, "I'm going to build you a healthy meadow. I'm going to build you a woodlot. And this is all the reasons why you should put this into your community's master plan or your parcel's reuse plan." And a lot of times people look at me with wide eyes and say, "Handel, I want to be alone. I have got so much to do with the regulations, the legal formulas, the forms I'm filling out, the public rules, the concern of liability. The last thing I need is a plant ecologist saying, 'I'm going to give you something else to do. I've got enough to do. Get out of here.'" And this, my friends, is a matter of public education, and that's, I spent a lot of time doing that. Showing, even though it's something else to do, something that engineers, lawyers, politicians have probably not been trained in, you can do this. There are people out there with the proper training at public institutions, whether it's cooperative extension or public universities or botanic gardens, who can help take some of this stuff off your plate and add to the greater benefit for the American public. And finally, here comes the sun, the Beatles' great line. We live in a world of changing climate. There's no question about that. The country is getting hotter and probably drier in most places. As we do restoration, it's not just for today. Some thought has to be given about 20 and 40 years from now when it's warmer and drier. There are plant species which can be installed which have that sort of toleration. And in fact, I recommend putting in the highest biodiversity as possible, knowing that 40 to 50 years from now, some things probably aren't going to make it because it's warmer, but other things will. The greater the biodiversity now, the greater the ecological sustainability for the future. And that, of course, is one of the great arguments for adding sustainable, diverse natural habitats to our communities. That's my last functional slide. The last one, I think, is just a thank you from Jeff's office. This is what I would like to say as a thank you and a goodbye. When I go to a construction site or a former brownfield or a landfill, I start by saying, let's assume that ecological restoration is possible here and useful here. And I'm going to assume that I'm going to put some native habitat in here unless there's some damn good reason for why I shouldn't. Even if the community or the landowner or the developer says, look, I really want to put in houses, I really want to put in a shopping mall with a Bloomingdale's, I'll say, well, look, maybe part of this site can have a buffer zone or a section of natural resources which will have public benefit, be a screen, be wildlife habitat, and get ecological services for the community. Of course, if you put in some natural habitat, very often you'll save money, not just on maintenance, but also on tax breaks if you say, well, this is going to be a conservation area. So there's a lot of ways where people can get real advantages, economic, social, and ecological, if you do restoration ecology. More and more I talk about the economic benefits because they're true and they're real, and it gets the attention. I don't want to be thought about just as someone who likes plants and likes to watch birds. These are benefits in terms of public health, public budgets, and long-term sustainability. And this is why I've pursued ecological restoration as a main thrust of my work at this stage of my career. And with that, I think I'll stop and entertain any more questions, Jeff.
No, thanks, Stephen. Before we jump on to the questions, I want you all to go, or if you're not already on slide 56, to please go there and then go ahead and click on the text that says links to additional resources. What we've done here is to upload a few of the some related materials, related websites supporting this the concepts that were brought up during the course of this presentation today. As I said earlier, the plan is to take the audio archive of this session, marry it back up with the slides and the links page, and have it on our Kluin studio pretty much in perpetuity until Stephen does it again and we update the audio track. Anyway, know that this is here. I know that I think Sunitha is online with us, and there are a few things that we promised we would include and update this list of resources. So look back in about 3-4 days, and we should have it upgraded. If you look over on the left-hand side, left-hand frame, underneath the Kluin logo, third tab down, you'll see something that says feedback, and it's an online feedback form. I just want to, before we go on to questions, encourage everyone to consider at least providing your feedback on today's session. I know that Scott's already got plans for Stephen to do this again, along with possibly Sally Brown and Rufus Cheney from USDA on some slightly other topics related to this field of work. So let us know what you think, because we take those comments into consideration and share those with the presenters as we move forward with the series of topics.
Yeah, they're very, very valuable to us as we move forward.
Thank you. With that, let's open it back up to questions. By schedule, we have about 12 minutes left, so if we don't need it all, we won't use it, but if we do, I'm more than welcome to stay and stay with it. So I'd like to open it up to the phone lines. If there's anybody on the phones who has a question, on anything that you heard today, please just identify yourself and where you're calling from. Anyone?
Dr. Handel, my name's John Lawson. I'm calling from Boise, Idaho.
Hi.
Your discussion about the meadow and the guy that said you can't burn it and you can't mow it and you can't touch it is something that a lot of communities face with landfills and sites that we're reclaiming, whether it be mine sites or Superfund sites. And typically the history of revegetation is that you put in these grasses, and a lot of them are pasture-type grasses that produce a lot of biomass, and what we see in the ecology of the whole thing is eventually they get choked out and the weeds come in. And
yes, I know that from my West Virginia work.
And you don't have a control over it, and you spend a lot of money in weed control. And so out in Idaho, we're dealing with some big repository sites that we're trying to manage this way, and burning is still somewhat of an option, except people really get uneasy about burning waste sites that are there for Superfund reasons. So what other kinds of solutions have you come across in your travels that might be amenable to this, to maintaining something like this?
Well, first I'll say, of course, there are places where control burns are being used by, you know, trained staff, and it's done with great success. I once lived in Sydney, Australia for a year, and control burning is a normal part of city life in the country of Australia. They have to get rid of that fuel load quickly, and their trained staff do it, and nobody worries about it because they really are expert. If you have a site where that kind of a remediation and disturbance really is troublesome, let's put it that way, you really have to think about what the appropriate target would be. If you want to keep a meadow or a diverse grassland for grassland birds, it may be impossible. There are a lot of noxious weeds, certainly in the West, as you know, that will sweep through sites after a decade or so if there's little money for management. In situations like that, I would think of a shrubland as a more appropriate target community, where you could put in a lot of arid land or modestly moist climate shrubs, and they will shade out a lot of the aggressive grasses, and the shrubs really don't require that kind of disturbance. They can often remain as shrublands for many, many decades, and slowly certain trees will move in. And I think that's a more appropriate target in situations where you don't have the ability, either in terms of regulations or in budget, to do these long-term disturbances which are needed to keep a diverse meadow going. Again, a lot of folks think that a wildflower meadow is like a front yard garden of pretty posies. It's just, it'll be that way forever. But it's not true. Just as public private front yards need fussing with every year, a meadow has to be fussed with over, you know, several years to keep it going. Or else it reverts to a woodland. And if you're surrounded by high population zones, very often the woodland is invasive species, which have trivial advantages for our citizens and for natural resources. So I think the target, if you can't disturb, should be more of a shrubland, and whether you're in a dry or a wet climate, there's a sizable pallet that you can get. I know certainly at the strip mines out west, shrublands are very often the closure procedure under the strip mining rules.
Stephen, I've got a question from Barry in Kentucky. It says, when meeting regulatory obligations, the yearly monitoring report requirements, the percent living stem requirements, etc., it is difficult to get buy-in from the reg agencies. How successful have you been in getting the U.S. Corps of Engineers to buy into a way of time planting effort slash etc. different from what folks are used to? It sort of follows along the yearly budget issue you raised earlier.
Yeah, a lot of it, I'm getting more and more cooperation both from the Corps and NOAA for our coastal work, and certainly the EPA has shown great vision, I might say, in all this. Very often trustees of these sites include people from Fish and Wildlife and state EPAs, And these are people who are trained biologists who I think are aware of the issues and can be partners. I would also like to say that very often the private sector, nonprofits like the Nature Conservancy or the Audubon Societies, these are sophisticated professionals who are pleased to come in and play a role during discussions about why these biodiverse natural habitats are in the public interest, let me put it that way. And we always encourage participation by the knowledgeable nonprofits who have great experience. You know, the Nature Conservancy, which is throughout our country, is very well respected and has state staffs which are highly trained in management of public lands, and they're thrilled to play a role because it's their mission as a respected nonprofit. So I try to get partners in to help me talking to the agencies. Yes, there is an administrative stasis and inertia. We all know that, and often it's because these agencies are overworked and understaffed. Good Lord. But I think bringing in some of these others, we're chipping away at it, and I across the nation, and I've seen this at the EPA meetings we talk at, greater and greater success on all fronts. And, you know, Scott, I think that's been your experience, too. Hello? Hi, I'm still here.
I'm sorry, it helps to take the mute button off.
Okay.
For those folks on the phone, one last shot at asking questions. Please identify yourself and where you're calling from.
Dr. Handel, this is John Lawson again in Boise. If nobody
Hi.
Wants
Hi.
To speak, I've got one other question for you, and that has to do with this issue of trees on caps and covers. And in the West, we see a lot of problems with trees coming in and roots establishing themselves, and then wind coming in and blowing the trees over and then compromising the cap.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a huge management issue, and I think your suggestion about shrubs is a good one because they have a similar type root system, but oftentimes more aggressive in terms of establishing a base.
Yeah.
And they don't have that high profile.
Yeah, this windrow issue is one I'm often asked about, and I can say a few things. First of all, in the references on the internet site, there's a long paper by Dobson and Moffat. They're British environmental officials, and they've got a chapter in there on windthrow. Basically, once these trees get to be sizable, the root mat is so broad, they're really very, very stable. I think a lot about this, and my usual answer is this. Look, you may get an occasional windstorm or gale that knocks down a few trees that rips up the stump, and you may get an exposed cap. But the normal maintenance on containment landfills and Superfund sites is to always have some routine maintenance to cover erosion gullies. And if you have a windthrow and there's a stump that pops out, I mean, all you really have is a small localized erosion gully that would be filled in by a dump truck of soil or bentonite and a crew of laborers who fill it in. It's much cheaper to fill in an occasional rare windthrow than it is to mow a whole site of 100 acres every month for 30 years. And when you think about ecological services a young woodlot can perform, whether it's limiting leachate by 30% or cooling air or making a public amenity, suddenly to me the public benefit goes towards the woodlot and say, look, occasionally we might have a windthrow we've got to fill in, but that we're still way ahead economically than if we had to mow this, for the next 30 years. So I sort of play the long-term benefit argument, and I think it's accurate.
All right. That's a great point, and I hadn't thought of it that way. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. The one other comment on the internet site was whether or not some of your papers were available in PDF, and that's probably something we can address after the call is over.
Well, Jeff, I'll be glad to mail you my papers, and you can scan them in for PDF.
Hey, we can.
We'll make a deal. We'll make a deal.
Sold. All right. If there aren't any, I'll open one last time. Anybody on the phones with a question? Last shot. Name and location. Hearing nothing. I think I move to close this. I want to thank Dr. Stephen Handel of Rutgers University for joining us today in a great lecture on ecological restoration. I'd like to thank all the participants. Look forward to talking to you again at some point in the future. As we mentioned earlier, there are a couple of other topics in this series that we're interested in getting online, and we're actually interested in redoing this one with Dr. Handel at some point in the fairly near future. So I guess for EPA and myself, thank you everyone for joining us, and it's time to sign off.
Thank you all. I thank you for your interest in this topic.